to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, April 13, 2022. President Salva Kiir appoints members from the various armed groups to the command of the unified forces.
When the peace process to move forward, and I think this has given at least a bit of push, you know, a bit of push. It's like, you have a car that almost got stuck, and because the fuel is smaller, you add small fuel, and the car is able to move at least a kilometer.
And the police in Jonglei State rearrest an outspoken woman for allegedly defaming officials.
The day before yesterday, my wife was arrested. She was issued the arrest warrant at 6:30. And I was there, I went through the arrest warrant, and at 6:30 we came to the police station.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese activist and an analyst says he welcomes the appointment of commanders for security agencies. Last night, President Salva Kiir issued a decree appointing commanders for the Army, Police, National Security Service, and Wildlife from the parties to the 2018 peace agreement. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir's decree, which went into effect immediately, was read live on state-owned television and radio. Several of Kiir's senior military officers were relieved of their duties in the security agencies. Top military officers in the SPLAIO and South Sudan Opposition Alliance were appointed to key positions in the agencies. Civil society activists and analysts say the move to finally unify the command structure of security agencies marks an important step in implementing security arrangements defined in the peace deal. Suara Nelson Loboka, executive director of Action 54, a local civil society group, welcomes Kiir's decree but says more practical steps should be taken to implement key tasks in the security arrangements.
This unification should not only remain in the papers. It should not only remain in the papers, and of course, it has to be backed by the graduation and the deployment of the necessary fight forces from the confinement areas and to their assignment to the field.
Loboka says now that a unified command structure exists, party leaders should encourage citizens from different communities to stop fighting.
Now that the command is in place, that challenge of those fighting or those attacks that, by others, I said, militias that have been backed by government and other militias owned by individuals. So meaning this unified command now will be important to tackle or to get into those matters.
Boboya James, a policy analyst with the Institute of Social Policy and Research, says the move portrays a positive gesture from party leaders who should push forward with the implementation of the peace deal.
We want the peace process to move forward, and I think this has given at least a bit of push. It's like, you have a car that almost got stuck, and because the fuel is smaller, you add small fuel, and the car is able to move at least a kilometer to a 1,000-kilometer distance that you are aiming to achieve.
Jamie says it's time that South Sudanese and the international community rally behind the peace process. Linda Tom, a spokesperson for the United Nations mission in South Sudan, says UNMISS has called on the parties to prioritize implementation of the remaining provisions of the peace deal, considering the transitional period expires in less than a year.
As intercommunal violence continues to surge in several parts of the country, UNMISS is urging all parties to respect the peace agreement. With less than 10 months of the transition period remaining, it is more important than ever that stakeholders work together to implement outstanding benchmarks of the peace deal.
The unification comes following a security deal the parties signed earlier this month, brokered by Sudan on security arrangements. Under the terms of the deal, the parties are expected to graduate the unified forces within 2 months following the unification of the command structure. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Police in Jonglei State Capital Borough rearrested a woman who accused police of arresting and stripping her naked last week for allegedly dressing indecently. A police spokesperson confirms Yar Ayuen Mabior is being interrogated for allegedly defaming the commander of the Joint Operation Force on social media. Dengai Deng has the details for VOA from Juba.
Bor town resident Kon John says security officers came to his home Monday night and arrested his wife, Yara Yuen Mabior, and took her to a police detention facility. He says Mabior has yet to be arraigned in court.
The case was settled by the community on Saturday, and the community had ordered my wife to at least tell the media that the case between her and Najang Ayuen is over, which she did. And day before yesterday, my wife was arrested. She was issued the arrest warrant at 6:30, and I was there. I went through the arrest warrant, and at 6:30 we came to the police station. So since then, it is now the third day. My wife has been in the prison, and as I speak to you, she's in the jail.
John says he is concerned about his wife's health after spending 3 days in a dilapidated detention center. John says the police violated his wife's constitutional rights by refusing to grant her bail and detaining her for more than 24 hours without producing her in court. He says he worries the general who filed a case of defamation might use his rank to influence the judicial system. Jonglei State Police spokesperson Major Majak Daniel Tuor says Mabior was rearrested for allegedly defaming the head of Joint Operation Force, Brigadier General Ajang Ayuen. Tuor says Mabior is being questioned and will be arraigned in a court of law to answer charges against her, but admits her arraignment was delayed and she has not been granted bail because police must first follow investigation procedures.
Yar Ayuen was arrested and the charges were laid on defamation to the commander of the operational forces pending investigation. And the investigation started yesterday. If today is finalized, then the investigation file will be forwarded to the public attorneys to go and assess and analyze whether there is a case for hearing or not.
The head of the Joint Operation Force, Brigadier General Ajang Ayuen, says he brought charges against Yar Ayuen Mabior because she defamed him.
Yar went live on Facebook and talked against me. I saw that she was tarnishing my image, so I filed a court case against her. I cannot allow her to continue talking about me in the media.
On Monday, Mabior said police arrested her last week and forced her to strip after security forces accused her of wearing indecent clothing. Mabior says she was on her way to market when security forces accused her of wearing suggestive clothing and arrested her. Rachel Adau, a women's rights activist with the Women Empowerment Center, South Sudan, says police have infringed on Mabior's rights.
The situation is becoming worse because they are pressuring her physically, emotionally. You know, she's not attending to her work and her family and the way it is being told. First step in everybody. So she's a human being and all the human rights are women rights. Someone must be held accountable. And that thing, he has to be, whoever is wrong, to be brought to book because that is misusing his powers.
In a recent week, some Bo town residents have complained that security operatives have verbally reprimanded women and in some cases, wived women and arrested them for infractions such as wearing short skirts or tight dresses. Jonglei Deputy Governor Antipas Nyok Kucha says state officials ordered security forces to crack down on gangs to curb criminal activity in Bo. Kucha says women and girls who dress indecently and identify with the youth gangs are also arrested.
The entire Bor town was overtaken by the niggers, whether girls or boys, terrorizing the civil population in the town. So when we said as a government and design a mechanism how to curb out and combat the issue of niggerism in the town. The case of that lady you talk about, she was found dressing indecently in the market.
Jonglei Governor Dinei Jok Chagur, who is visiting Washington, told VOA he ordered security operatives to stop the practice. He said he did not order the crackdown. The arrest of women in Bor because of the clothes they wear has sparked debate on social media. Some residents and activists argue the arrests are a clear violation of freedom of expression under international human rights law. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Juba.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sudan is expressing concern over intercommunal clashes in the Darfur region, which have killed more than 100 people and displaced about 15,000 others since late last month. An officer with UNHCR in Khartoum says the displaced are exposed to harsh conditions and are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Khartoum.
The UNHCR office in Sudan says since March 26, clashes have occurred between two nomadic communities in Gereda and Toulouse localities of South Darfur state. The fighting reportedly stems from an incident when a Rapid Support Forces soldier from one nomadic community was killed by unknown assailants while traveling from Gereda town to Buram village. On March 29, members of an armed nomadic community attacked three villages inhabited by nomadic communities of Hasheba, Idan, and Umbalula in the southwest part of Greater Town. Authorities say more than 20 combatants from both tribes were killed during the conflict. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, UNHCR Communications Officer Asadullah Nasrullah says the renewed clashes have exposed thousands of vulnerable communities to harsh living conditions.
On 6 April, the South Darfur Protection Working Group participated in an interagency emergency response mission to affected villages in Greda and Toulouse localities where recent conflicts has affected an estimated 15,000 people. Over 100 persons have reportedly been killed since clashes began.
Nasrullah says 6 victims are said to be children. He says humanitarian organizations are ramping up to provide life-saving support once they have safe access to affected communities. Nasrullah says other deadly intercommunal clashes were reported in the Jebel Moon locality of West Darfur, which leading to the displacement of 12,000 people. He says more than 3,600 people, mostly women and children, have crossed the border into the neighboring Chad.
During the month of March, Jebel Moon locality in West Darfur witnessed continued intercommunal clashes, claiming the lives of over 40 people and a higher number of injured. New displacement, burning of villages, and destruction of civilian homes and property have been reported.
Nasrullah says Jebel Amir and Al Sarif localities of North Darfur state also witnessed clashes late last month, which led to the killing of 2 people and the displacement of 325 families. He says conflict has significantly hindered humanitarian access to the area and delivery of life-saving assistance. Humanitarian officials in West Darfur state also confirmed that other communal clashes have been reported in the Sirba locality, 45 kilometers northwest of Al Janina town. Speaking by phone from Al Janina town, Asadiq Muhammad Ahmad, who heads the state humanitarian department, says intercommunal clashes continue. Muhammad says, till last night, the fighting was still continuing, and we had unconfirmed number of displacement and injuries. He says, at this moment, we don't have the exact number of people killed, injured, and displaced during the ongoing conflict. Muhammad says his office has no detail of causes of conflict in Sirba locality. He says state authorities have deployed forces into the area aimed at restoring security and stability and to separate the conflicted communities. Jebel Moon experienced a wave of violence in November last year when Arab nomad attacks farmers in the area. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says at least 43 people were killed and 46 villages were burned down and looted. Intercommunal clashes have been reported in most parts of Darfur since the joint United Nations and African Union peacekeeping mission ended its mandate in December 2020. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, families in Africa face food crisis. Find out why after the break.
do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how is the birth of a child celebrated in your culture?
When we give birth in our culture, they simply take a baby somewhere there inside a house. They gather together as a family. They bring pots of milk. They slaughter goats. So they dance. That's how we easily celebrate.
I understand in a very simple way that when a baby boy is born, it is celebrated for the first 3 days with some local drinks, some local beverages, something of that kind.
They give them cows. Yeah. Once you give birth to a baby, they give him or her cattle. So that's the way how they celebrate it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. An estimated 250 million people in Africa lack access to daily food, with the number impacted in West and Central Africa expected to reach a record high. Officials and aid groups from more than 50 African countries met this week in Equatorial Guinea to discuss ways of improving the continent's agricultural food systems. Hanika Hamschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
The UN World Food Programme says the number of people affected by the ongoing food crisis in West and Central Africa has quadrupled over the last 3 years, rising from 10.7 million in 2019 to 41 million today. Countries in the Horn of Africa are also experiencing one of their worst food crises following 3 consecutive poor rainy seasons. Food insecurity has caused a massive nutrition crisis, particularly among small children. It has also fueled a huge population displacement as people leave rural areas in search of better economic opportunities. Many factors are at play. Extreme weather events such as drought and floods are occurring more regularly. And in some countries, conflict prevents farmers from planting or harvesting crops. As a result, many African countries have become increasingly reliant on food imports. So when the COVID-19 pandemic hit and disrupted global and regional trade, the continent suffered. Abebe Haye Gabriel is the Assistant Director General of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization.
Each time a new crisis hits, it adds to what is already a very precarious situation. And the economic base is not very strong. Productivity and production of food is one of the lowest in the world. Not enough is being produced.
The situation has been further complicated by the war in Ukraine. More than 20 African countries depend on Ukraine or Russia or both for wheat imports, Haley Gabriel said, including 13 which depend on the warring nations for more than half of their annual wheat supply. Many African countries are also heavily reliant on fertilizer imports from Russia. Benoit Thierry is the West Africa representative for the International Fund for Agricultural Development.
In Africa, not all countries are self-sufficient. Senegal is importing 50% of its food, and we think that all the governments should now get organized to ensure self-sufficiency in their countries. And for that, you need investment plans in agriculture.
Past agricultural plans have had a scope of 3 to 5 years, Thierry said, but governments should be thinking longer term. At this week's UN Food Conference, government officials are expected to discuss ways of decreasing Africa's dependence on imports by providing emergency support to farmers, taking advantage of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, and investing in ecosystem restoration and resource management. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
UN agencies are calling on international donors to act now and provide funds needed to prevent another potentially devastating famine in Somalia. Millions of Somalis are in need of life-saving assistance, as Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
3 years of extreme drought has brought Somalia to its knees. Some 6 million people, or 40% of the population, are facing acute hunger because the rains have failed, their crops have withered, and their livestock has died. The United Nations says 750,000 people have been forced to leave their homes in search of food for themselves and grazing land for their cattle. Last week, a UN food security report stated that Somalia is on the brink of a humanitarian disaster. Etienne Peter Schmidt is the UN Food and Agriculture Organization representative in Somalia. Speaking from the capital, Mogadishu, Peter Schmidt says some 81,000 people already are suffering from catastrophic conditions in some areas of the country. He says they are facing starvation, malnutrition, loss of livestock, crops and other assets, and eventually disease and death.
Almost a quarter of a million people died the last time famine was declared in Somalia. And with the current likelihood of poor rain, skyrocketing food prices, and huge funding shortfall, as was already mentioned also, it means a perfect storm is brewing for another catastrophic event in which millions of people are at risk of sliding into famine.
Children accounted for nearly half of the 250,000 people who died in Somalia's last famine in 2011. So far, the UN's $1.4 billion 2022 humanitarian response plan for Somalia is less than 5% funded. The World Food Program's deputy country director in Somalia, Lara Fossey, says her agency must make some hard choices on how to distribute aid because of a lack of money.
We've already prioritized our very limited nutrition funding to treat malnutrition rather than to prevent it. And this, of course, will mean that more people are likely then to fall into needing treatment for acute malnutrition in the longer term. And we're taking from the hungry to feed the starving.
Fossey warns the threat of famine may force people into negative coping strategies like selling off livestock and other assets that, she says, will undermine their long-term ability to support themselves and force them to remain dependent on humanitarian relief. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroon observed International Day for Street Children on April 12. Removing kids from the streets in the capital Yaoundé and the economic hub Douala, among the thousands of street children are orphans, refugee children from the troubled Central African Republic, and children fleeing Boko Haram terrorism. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Rights and humanitarian groups moved from street to street, visiting markets, riversides and abandoned buildings in Cameroon's capital city Yaoundé in search of homeless children. When they were found, some children agreed to go to shelters. Others refused and were given clothes and food. Rachel Balafai heads the Street Child Center, a Yaoundé charity. She says the search was conducted at night because that is when searchers are sure they can find the street children and see the conditions under which they live.
La plupart de ces jeunes garçons ont perdu leurs parents. Au nord, on leur a dit que la vie.
Balafai says her association gave food and clothing to 230 street children this week in Yaoundé, who are from Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. She says uninformed people in northern Cameroon make children believe there are many opportunities to improve their living conditions in Douala and Yaoundé, Cameroon's largest cities. Balafai says some of the children are orphans. On International Day for Street Children, non-governmental organizations and the government invited traditional leaders and the clergy to give support to street children. The Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries of Cameroon took part at the event. Moussa Oumarou is the council's coordinator.
La question des enfants de la rue est une question importante.
Oumarou says parents and family members should know that it is their collective responsibility to take care of their children. He says street children need love and care and should not be battered or treated as people rejected or ostracized by society or by religious groups. Oumarou says the government should remove all children from the streets and make sure the children are given an education, which is a fundamental human right. Cameroon reports that the number of street children in major cities increased from 10,000 to about 27,000 within the past 3 years. Some of the children are refugees fleeing instability in the Central African Republic. Others fled insecurity caused by Boko Haram attacks in northern Cameroon and the conflict between the government and separatist groups in Cameroon's western regions. Pauline Irène-Guéné is Cameroon's Minister of Social Affairs.
Aujourd'hui, le problème se pose même encore plus avec acuité parce que nous avons...
Guéné says several conflicts Cameroon and its neighbors are experiencing contribute to the increase in the number of street children. She says the government is struggling to contain the crisis and working to return children and displaced persons to their communities. Cameroon is encouraging families and communities to assist the government by providing shelter, accommodation, and access to education for the street children. Speaking on Cameroon State Radio CRTV, Ngene said the government will house, feed, and educate street children and urge them to leave the streets. She said at least 250 children have either been reunited with their families or enrolled in schools within the past year. The government says the number of street children may continue to grow in the urban centers where, unfortunately, about 40% of the population lives below the poverty line. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now end the show with Gordon Kong and the song Anna Sudani. Listening to Gordon Kong and the song Anna Sudani. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
One day later, oh, here we are.